The general theme comes from a book which I ordered, but which somewhere, my order didn't get filled, by Paul Menier, who used to teach New Testament at Yale, and he's retired, and he raises in here several specific issues dealing with the general theme of what, you know, we call patriotism in the Bible. And what I would like to talk about would be today's civil religion, and then tomorrow on amnesty, because these all have very strong biblical overtones and connections, which I think we want to explore in some detail. And since civil religion is going to be very much on our minds, and just now, and amnesty is too, it's a good time to talk about them. For instance, I was just reading in the Seattle Times, there's a big issue in the United Presbyterian Church as to what kind of a joint service the United Presbyterians are going to have on July 4th, which is a Sunday. And there's they've been trying to get all the presbyteries together in western Washington, and they haven't been able to because they all have such strong feelings. Well, Presbyterians are pretty stubborn anyway, but like some others I know, but they're having some strong feelings on what the ceremonies should be, because there are some people are saying that any kind of church commemoration of the 4th of July is a civil rather than a religious kind of service, and that's you know, kind of potent things. They would apparently just want to go ahead and as though July 4th, 1976 doesn't exist.
Eighth Sunday after Pentecost.
Yeah, and they let it go at that. And I'm not so sure that that's right. Myself, I'm not so sure that, and this is what I want to just raise the questions with you, that we can't have some kind of loyalty and reverence, well, that's probably too strong a word, or loyalty or respect for what we would call our national heritage and national traditions without it becoming pagan or without it becoming too secular or simply, you know, too close an identification with the world. I think the problem is one which we never anticipated happening, and that is when Richard Nixon was reelected in 1972, he fully expected to preside over the bicentennial in 1976. It was going to be the crowning benediction, really. And I shouldn't be sarcastic, you know, and pick the carcass, as he said, you know, anymore, but this is going to be the crowning benediction for his administration. And the bicentennial, I think, you know, if he hadn't gotten in all this other trouble, the bicentennial really might have become a rather, you know, important and exciting kind of event, because in 1876, it really was a remarkable sort of thing. Everybody was optimistic, even though we had a depression and had just finished Reconstruction and all the rest, and there was a kind of a hope and a goodwill and a trusting atmosphere at the time. But I think now, for two reasons. One, we're so disenchanted, as we know so well, about what happened in recent years, and also because the bicentennial has become the BUY centennial. You know, there, I saw a marvelous little spoof. Jack knows there's a sort of an extemporaneous theater group in Minneapolis called the Dudley Riggs Brave New Workshop, and they did a marvelous spoof on who will buy the bicentennial. And now, you all, maybe you can add some atrocity stories here. I know of red, white, and blue caskets. That's my prize example. I don't know if you've got
red,
anything.
Red, white, and blue toilet seats.
Toilet seats. You know, and like Leo last night, he took it serious. I mean, you know, he did a spoof on it, and that's great. But most of us, I think, are, you know, pretty fed up. What was it, Princess Margaret's wedding? And they had all sorts of memento pillow slip coverings and ashtrays, and nobody bought it. They were caught, you know, with enormous things. But frankly, people are buying things, but now with little mementos and all the rest, but it's going to get worse before it gets better. But thank goodness it's going to be over, you know, in less than 2 weeks, that part of it. It'll be interesting to see if any bicentennial things go on after July 4th. I don't know. If it sells, I suppose it will. But I think we are kind of cynical about the whole thing because, and expressions of piety towards our past, national past, and tradition and all the rest, because we have had too much of the commercial side of it and too much disenchantment with the country in recent years. And hence we, I think, have tended to become rather suspicious of any form of what I would call respect for our past and any kind of commemoration for this. We're so afraid, I think, of being labeled super patriots or flag wavers, all the rest, that the tendency seems to go, I think, too much in the other direction. And also, there's always the real problem here of over-familiarity. We're so familiar with the great ideas of what I'm going to call in a minute here our civil religion, that it's very hard to find anything new to say, for instance, about the Declaration of Independence or some of Lincoln's most famous statements, or some of these things, all the rest. But to get into the subject on civil religion, which I want to raise for discussion, and I have a couple of, I think, interesting items here for discussion here, I think it's fair, without having to go into any kind of evidence here, that the United States, like almost every other reasonably large country has, besides its various forms of organized denominational religion. It has had since 1776 a form of what we call civil religion. Some people say that it really doesn't exist, but ever since a sociologist at Berkeley, Robert Bella, wrote a famous, now famous essay on it, the civil religion in America, it's come into its own. I know I've gone to umpteen number of conferences on it till I'm almost tired of it, and so on. But what was interesting was that we found at some of the conferences that other countries have had the same kind of civil religion over a long period of time, just as America has. And what I mean very briefly by civil religion would be those ideals and values on which we all can agree, which hold the country together, so that we're not at each other's throats. Because the one time civil religion didn't hold us together, we got a civil war in this country. And when you look, for instance, at the world today, the best example of what I'm trying to get at here by the idea of consensus is you look at, say, Lebanon, or you look for the last 4 or 5 years at Northern Ireland, and obviously no consensus, you know, exists there on what kind of society they want and where the people want their nation to go. And when you have a lack of consensus, you can have something as disastrous as Lebanon. And I feel especially close to that because one of the colleagues in my department is from Beirut, and his parents did get out mercifully, and they aren't here yet, but they have told him some stories that never get into the press. I guess it's far worse in terms of killing civilians than we've ever, you know, imagined, because simply the consensus that held Lebanon together has simply evaporated. And so in our country, we have for the most part agreed on the basics, as contrasted to other countries where you've had class against class or race against race, and leading eventually to violence and virtual to destruction. And I would suppose that if you're looking at specific examples of what we call the civil religion in America, everybody agrees on the ideas in the Declaration of Independence. I don't think there'd be anybody in this country who would disagree with the ideas that are put forward in Jefferson's preamble. And what's interesting, of course, with the Declaration is that it's the sort of thing that conservatives and moderates and liberals and radicals of all kinds and stripes can use to justify this. There's a marvelous discussion of how different groups have justified their positions on the basis of being, you know, loyal patriots. There's a very far-out group, and it'll be fun to watch what they do on July 4th, called the People's Bicentennial Commission. I don't know if any of you follow the BPC, Maury Riskin, and some leftover new leftists from the 60s is what it amounts to, who sometimes behave themselves and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're really just downright rude and breaking up meetings with a lot of noise and so on. But they claim that they're the heirs, the true heirs of the American Revolution and of the Declaration of Independence. But I think the Declaration of Independence certainly is the best example of what we would call civil religion in this country. That is the ideals and values which hold us together, which on which we agree, but which also have a transcendent referent. That's the point. It isn't simply a convenient set of ideas which are uniquely American, but the genius of the American Revolution, the ideology of the American Revolution, and Jefferson kept talking about this, and Tom Paine did, was that the revolution for all mankind. That these weren't the rights just for Americans, but these were universal rights. One grumpy old historian, some of you might know, Daniel Boorstin, doesn't like this idea, but he's been writing nasty things about that it was only a very particularist local revolution and so on. But he has a good deal of trouble, and finally with his ideas, and finally he gave up, and now he's become head librarian right at the Library of Congress, and he books don't talk back to him the way his students and his colleagues used to, so he doesn't get any arguments anymore. And I don't like Daniel Boorstin's ideas, by the way, if you haven't gathered that. But you remember. This universal theme is terribly important because in the most important document besides the Declaration in 1776 was Tom Paine's little pamphlet, Common Sense. And at the end of Common Sense, he says, you know, O ye who love mankind. You know, he's talking about freedom has been departed from Asia and Africa has expelled her and Europe and Asia have told her, you know, to leave and all these things. And therefore, the only place that freedom has a chance to survive is, you know, in the 13 colonies, which became the 13 states. And the sense of universality in this funny little, you know, conglomeration of colonies we suddenly call a nation tended to give the American people, I think, the sense of uniqueness and of transcendence, really, that what they're fighting for is simply not themselves but for all people. And once American people have accepted that, it simply becomes something which we take for granted. And it's been given a lot of very bad expressions over the years, but it's been given, of course, some very noble expressions also. What I'm trying to say here is that the second major contributor to American civil religion was Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln caught this so very well, the idea of judgment under God, yet the universality of the American experiment, and the sense that America is being judged by history. Remember, in fact, in his annual message to Congress in 1862, he's talking about that history is watching us. History is noting what happens here. What happens here is going to affect the rest of mankind. That it isn't just a battle over slaves, or just isn't a battle over money or property or taxes or anything else like this, but it has a kind of a universality to it because of the unique position of America as a nation which has based its ideals, its consensus, its civil religion, if you like, on the basis of a transcendent reference. And this goes, you know, all the way through our political rhetoric, and it shows up not only in certain statements, but it shows up, you know, in certain ceremonies and in certain rituals and symbols and all the rest that we have. We're the only country, for instance, that has something like Thanksgiving Day. We're the only country that has something like Memorial Day, just as it is. But Memorial Day, really, I suppose, would be the best example of American civil religion. Because what we're really saying there in Memorial Day is that the soldiers who died for America, in a sense, were the expiation for the sins, not only of the nation, but of the world, and therefore their death is made meaningful. Because it atones for the past mistakes and errors and sins, if you like, really, of the nations. And in a very real sense, there's a sense of expiation and that takes place there. And therefore, we always have clergymen associated with Memorial Day services. And usually Memorial Day services are in cemeteries, which are very close to transcendent, which have a sort of a transcendent element to them. If you're interested, the best one on this, it's old, but it's still the best, Lloyd Warner, who was a famous sociologist. He and his wife did a study on Muncie, Indiana. No, that's the Lynns, I'm sorry. That's Robert the Lynns, who were the parents of Stoutenland, the great, you know, new left historian of the 60s. But Lloyd Warner, that's right, Yankee City, did this marvelous study on Memorial Day as the sort of the epitome of American civil religion, as a ceremony. But everybody understands, you know, what happens on Memorial Day. And it becomes really, in every sense of the word, a religious kind of ceremony. And that you justify war, for instance. War is simply a means to the end. And that you don't glorify it, but you justify it. And you find meaning, and you add meaning to the dignity to those who sacrificed. And we have other, you know, religious, patriotic observances which aren't simply to glorify the state, but which always give the impression that America, you know, as we like to say in our Pledge of Allegiance, is a nation under God. And like to hold on to that, which is another reinforcement, really, for the whole idea, really, of civil religion. Let me read very briefly what Bella says as way of connection with this sort of thing. Although matters of personal religious belief, worship, and association are considered to be strictly private affairs, there are at the same time certain common elements of religious orientation that the great majority of Americans share. This public religious dimension is expressed in a set of beliefs, symbols, and rituals that I am calling the American civil religion. The inauguration of a president is an important ceremonial event in this religion. Always the president puts his hand on the Bible. And you remember when Kennedy was there, it wasn't going to be a Protestant Bible, and everybody was all upset that it was going to corrupt that it was going to corrupt the whole administration or the government because it wasn't a Protestant Bible. And we survived. Anyway, I'm not at all convinced that the leaders of the churches have consistently represented a higher level of religious insight than the spokesman of this civil religion. That's a powerful statement. Because Bella really sort of likes the civil religion, is what really he's saying at its best in terms of, as it was expressed in the Declaration, as it was expressed in the ideas of, let's say, of Abraham Lincoln. And he thinks it's just as profound there as has been expressed many times by other religious leaders. All right, here's the point for us. Behind the civil religion, at every point, lie biblical archetypes. Exodus, chosen people, promised land, New Jerusalem, sacrificial death and rebirth. But it is also genuinely American and genuinely new. It has its own prophets and its own martyrs, its own sacred events and sacred places. Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. It's a religious place to go to, absolutely. Grant's tomb in Riverside Park. It's just like going to a temple. You have the remains of the great leader. You have a quiet atmosphere of reverence. You have virtually icons, if you like, there for adoration. Carlton J. H. Hayes has written a marvelous essay about this, the comparison between religious and political observances, the difference between Memorial Day and some religious holidays and so on. Anyway, he finishes up and says this: it is concerned that America be a society as perfectly in accord with the will of God as men can make it, and a light to all the nations. And in his essay, he has a marvelous conclusion. He said, if you think this is an old-fashioned, antiquated idea that belonged to the flag wavers of the 1840s or the imperialists of the 1890s, he quoted the last statement from President Kennedy's inauguration in 1961, that truly God's work on earth must be our own. And you can't accuse John Kennedy, obviously, of being sort of an 1890s, old-fashioned tub-thumper, patriotic drumbeater, about as sophisticated a president as we've ever really had. He only used it to show that the idea of civil religion is very much alive and well throughout the country. All right. The question, of course, that comes up with civil religion is how far can one take it in terms of understanding one's ultimate loyalty and commitment in terms of one's, religious commitments. How dangerous is it to believe that in this particular case with the United States, since that's what we're talking about, that the civil religion might very well become, and it has, I think, for many, I don't know, many people, but for people, it has become a replacement for what we would call the Christian faith. Let me read a little bit here from the LCA pamphlet on this interpretation. To put it scripturally, one cannot serve two masters. To confess that Jesus is the Christ precludes confessing any other reality is ultimately true. Any other realities are penultimate in light of this confession, and they include civil unity, national destiny and purpose, and the political ideas which the nation avows. It would be a mistake to conclude that that penultimate realities are therefore not important. Within the Christian community's confession is also the assertion that things which are penultimate are nevertheless vehicles of God's activity in the world. For God works through even the most apparently mundane elements of creation. But ultimate meaning and purpose for human beings are not given by government, patriotism, or any other human creation. The danger of civil religion is that it claims to provide ultimate meaning and purposes. It is a religion. Its God might be, quote, the will of the people, the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the ability of reason to discern natural law, or something else given absolute status. But no matter how useful and commendable each of these may be for the civil unity, when absolute status is given to any of them, a demonic distortion of reality takes place. This judgment cannot be avoided by those who confess that absolute status belongs only to God, made manifest in Jesus the Christ. To confess that only Jesus is Lord puts one in constant tension with everything else. It is a tension of affirming the importance of the world as God's creation, and at the same time affirming that the things of this world are not God, nor do they perfectly reflect God's will. The danger of civil religion is that it dissolves this tension, this paradox of being in but not of the world. And it tends, obviously, and has tended to glorify that which we like to think is purely the will of God for our lives. Now, to get the discussion started here, let me pose a specific situation which came up in my original hometown. I think it raises the issue of civil religion very nicely. A member of the church council in my home proposed that as their bicentennial project, the local congregation pay for and erect a large flagpole, and that the American flag fly every day in front of First Lutheran Church in Kenyon, Minnesota. Now, how would you react if you were on the church council to a proposal that, as its bicentennial project, that you raise funds or whatever source you use and put it right out in front? Evelyn?
I know that some of our foreign students at Texas Lutheran, when they have worshiped in the church in town where there has been a flag, sometimes an American flag, have been rather startled because they, I guess, had a different concept of the church. And I've just been aware of the reaction of foreign students when they see an American flag in front of the church or in a church, that they're uncomfortable. So I think we have to see it from a global viewpoint.
I'm born and bred here, and it makes me very uncomfortable to see an American flag in a church or on church grounds.
Why?
I don't see it there.
There we go. Good.
Now I like to see both the Christian and the American flag around the altar.
Why are you uncomfortable?
Because, well, it's that two masters thing. I don't want anything competing with Christ. The only symbol I want to see, I don't want to see national or regional symbols in the church. I want the church to be something universal and overarching.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I feel the same way, because I think we
think of all the things that we don't want associated with the church that we do associate with Americanism. Probably, you know, a lot of the things, I guess, that we're really reacting strongly against are the idea that Americanism is right and the gospel can fit in where it does.
Yeah, that Christianity is a subset of American culture.
It's something that sort of belongs to it.
Well, I wonder, why do you like to see it there? Yeah, I think maybe switching was...
I think we may have a generation gap here.
Well, I think that I feel like I get the feeling that traditionally, when God is called upon in any kind of civic ceremony or when the flag is put up in the church, it's sort of saying that we're doing so well because God is on our side, or that we are doing so well is evidence that we are doing God's will, or something like that. And some things I don't think we've done have been right necessarily, I guess.
Evelyn?
I think there's some historical roots for the use of the flag in certain parts of Lutheranism, particularly the German strain. Because I remember my husband telling about his father, who did come from Germany, and a lot of the German pastors and German congregations were under some pressure in World War I to prove that they were loyal Americans. Mm-hmm. And my husband said that, like, his father was then the leading bond salesman in Nemaha County, Nebraska, and things like that, selling war bonds. And I think at least in that segment of the church, that may have been almost in self-defense to show that German Lutherans are also loyal Americans.
Yeah, that's true not only in Nebraska, but it's true throughout the whole Middle West, especially with German Lutheranism. I know in my community there were the Hinkle brothers who refused to buy war bonds. I don't know what they call them in World War I. I forget what. Which ones?
Liberty
bonds, that's right, Liberty bonds, right. And they refused to buy them. They weren't pro-German, but they just didn't want to buy Liberty bonds, and they woke up one morning and their barn had been painted yellow by some of the local zealots, I suppose you could call them, in our community. Yet there are large numbers of Americans who see no contradiction or problem with having the flag.
Is this ecumenical? I mean, do all churches and denominations have this Christian and American flag up in front, or is it a local thing?
Well, don't you think that I feel that this is a way we're giving thanks to God for our freedom, for America? I mean, we wouldn't have been a country if God wouldn't have guided us here. Maybe that's what I feel, a thanksgiving as I face that altar for all the things God has given me, especially my Savior and the Christian flag, but then that I'm free to live in America. That's what it means to me. And I like to see both of them.
What about a United Nations flag?
Yeah, what about all the poor people who live somewhere else where they don't have the political freedoms? They also have reason to give thanks to God for other things.
What does that have to do with
it? Yeah, that's what it doesn't mean. Okay. Okay.
I mean, they can raise their flag and give thanks for what they have in their country. I think we're kind of equating all this universalism into something that isn't.
Well, yesterday...
Yeah, can we hear from Denmark?
I've never seen, I think, a Danish flag in a Danish church.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Except for, well, some special reasons it might be, perhaps in some churches, for confirmation. But I was thinking the other day, out in the place where we have a summer house, that's a fishing place in North Sjælland, and they put up the Danish flags outside the church on Sundays. And I haven't seen it in very many villages in Denmark anyway, but I think it's... In Denmark, you hoist the flag when you have a birthday, or the Queen's birthday, or your own birthday if you live out in the country. And I think there was something, or a wedding, something nice and,
festive.
Yes.
Right. I see that.
And as we have, we must admit, the white cross on the red, mm-hmm. on the red bottom, it should be very much of a kind mm-hmm. of Christian symbol. If we don't consider it perhaps not
With Denmark, it's not an accident that the cross is on the flag. That's not a coincidence.
Well, the old story goes that it came down from heaven in Estland, 900 and something. I'm not very good at remembering years, but they were.
Oh, fine.
Mm-hmm.
Theirs is red, yeah.
But the Scandinavian countries as such, and Greece, they've got the white
Yes,
cross.
That's right.
Well, Britain is multiple crosses.
Yes. Three crosses.
Yeah. Three crosses. That's deliberate?
Oh, yeah.
It is.
There could be no doubt.
Well, I thought it was a nice design, right? Three, right. But now, is it, you think we have here, because some of the younger ones have expressed, you know, rather negative attitudes, and you think there's a possibility there may be a generation gap?
Well, I guess maybe if I thought that it was a more articulated understanding of what the flag was doing there, that I wouldn't be so uncomfortable with it. For instance, after listening to the tapes yesterday, between Coulson and Hughes, and having them say that their politics were miles apart, but yet they were brothers in Christ. If they wanted to have a flag where they worship, good, because I'd know that they weren't trying to claim that flag stood for one certain thing, maybe, under the gospel.
I don't think that it's saying that it stands for any one certain thing. Just like I was looking around, we wear these jackets, of course, you know, people wear things with emblems on them. And I don't think it's so much saying that anything is better than anything else, but some sort of an identity type of thing. And it doesn't bother me.
Well,
go ahead, I don't want to.
But it can be. I mean, someone can understand it a certain way, or everyone does understand it a certain way, I suppose. And, I was reading a review, I haven't read the book yet, in our newspaper of Senator Hatfield's new book, Between a Rock and a Hard Place. And he is saying one of the things that he's discussing in his book is he very nearly decided to leave the Senate during the Southeast Asian War because of his stand against it. So many important Christians, I guess, as far as spokesmen for the country, you know, were writing him these very nasty letters and phoning him up and telling him that it was, you know, absolutely unchristian for him to be opposed to the war. And that kind of idea sort of upsets me, that they thought that that kind of patriotism was unchristian. Where it doesn't have, maybe it doesn't, I don't see Christianity myself as tying you down to a block of every single ethical decision or political decision, but some, apparently that can be identified for some people.
Because there, you remember right during the height, well, it was the 1968 Democratic Convention where it really got started, where the flag really became a political statement. Mm-hmm. And when Reader's Digest enclosed a little flag as a decal.
Yeah.
And some of the hippies were flying the flag upside down and got in all kinds of trouble for it. And Jerry Rubin coming out, you know, with a red, white, and blue flag painted on his chest when he testified in front of Congress, and so on. And I wish they hadn't given him any publicity. He would have gone away, you know, rather quickly. But
that's probably a lot of what we're reacting to very much.
Yeah,
is that when putting that flag decal in your car automatically associated you with, you
because,
know,
for instance, if you see a policeman with a flag on his jacket, that's a political statement, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. When it loves me the most is America, love it or leave it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I think that probably I sort of associate people who put flags places as saying. Yeah.
Well, like in, if you go to New York, somebody wants to stand up and give a speech, he's got to have his little flag.
In Minneapolis, too.
You know, you plant your flag, then you can give your street and corner speech.
Yeah, that goes way, way back to the old days with the, yeah, that's true. That's, it is a way of getting rid of undesirable speakers, because if you were really loyal to Russia, is what they really mean by that, if you're really loyal to the USSR, you wouldn't put an American flag in front of your little statement. That's, you know,
the kookiest people in the world. Put a flag up, then you can say whatever you want to say.
Well, that matches what you said about the sacred documents before. It doesn't really matter what they say, but anybody who wants to have a hearing has to say that he's all for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is like in the tradition of Lutheran theology. No matter what sort of new development or move, you have to show that's what Luther was really intending to say.
You start with Luther first, right, no matter what it was, yeah.
We are dealing here then with mythologies. It doesn't... To come to these people and say, but that isn't what the Declaration of Independence really says. That's not what it's being used for. It's being waved like a flag, and since I'm waving it, I expect you to listen to me.
You think that's sort of the, how do I say it, the price we pay for having the ability to having the freedom, as you mentioned, to not have to agree with everybody else on everything. The fact that since we do want to have freedom of expression, we want the Bill of Rights and all these things, that we will have to deliberately maintain sort of an ambiguity about our symbols, like the flag, that will mean one thing to you and something else to somebody, something else to another person, Barb?
I think the flag, you know, the whole American spirit, always is associated with a war. Unity under the flag as associated with war. And I see so very little support for that kind of an idea anymore. If we're going to have unity at all, it's going to have to be in a whole different plane, at least for me. We can't even get behind the UN or any kind of peacemaking movements still. We're still hung up in the unity, the United States as a unity in opposition to others. And I guess, maybe it is an age thing or something. We, even at the seminary, we had a flag. Some guy wanted, the American Legion gave a flag to us at the seminary and said, you put it up, we'll give it to you free. We put it up, and a bunch of us wanted to take it down because we sort of, that's what we still felt, but there was such apathy, even in the seminary, that we couldn't get anything right. So, there's...
Probably hostility instead of apathy.
It's a reaction to a war that America couldn't get united enough behind to raise their flag anymore.
So I think there's no question that you're right about the war thing, and that the changing attitude towards war all across the country, all across the world, that the war isn't the old noble thing it used to be. If you ever have the chance on a late movie thing on television, see an old British imperialist thing called Three Feathers. It also is a name for another product, but it glorifies the imperialism. They showed the brave soldiers going off to the Boer War or something, and children throwing flowers in the path, and it's a whole different world. It's like seeing Gone with the Wind, and noticing all the racist portrayals that you find there. And today we couldn't get by with that kind of picture anymore. The only kind of picture you could get by with is an anti-war kind of picture. Dr. Strangelove, or my particular favorite, is Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory, which was 57, but was still already anti-war. And I think, it is a historical sort of thing that deals with the flag. Well, some of the rest of us remember there's a Star-Spangled Banner waving somewhere. Remember, we went through World War II. Remember, there'll be blue cliffs over the white cliffs of Dover, blue birds over the white cliffs of Dover, and coming in on a wing and a prayer. Look ahead, there's our field over there, with our trust in the Lord. And praise the Lord and pass the ammunition, really. You've heard this speech all the time. You don't really know how bad it was under the Depression. You don't really know how bad it was under Hitler.
Yeah. You really upset me. This really upsets me, and this, as being a teacher of smaller children all the time, the one thing I've taught them is to reverence for the flag and the respect, and that this is what I want them to feel. And even as I go back to my college now, and we stand for the Star-Spangled Banner, and so often I see this black group of people that just refuse to even stand up. They're not even patriotic enough to do it, and this upsets me. I guess I feel everyone, but this is just me.
Well, no, I have to say there that there's the Supreme Court even has ruled that you can't require anybody to stand for the Star-Spangled Banner. Yes, that's West Virginia versus... That was
was there a ruling on that?
Yeah, 1942 or 1943, really. It was Jehovah's Witnesses who refused to salute the flag or stand for the Star-Spangled Banner, right. And because that's a very difficult kind of problem, but...
We can't even let the children in school. They have the right to sit down while the rest of us are up if it's Jehovah's Witness. There's nothing that we can do there.
Okay.
Well, I think it's a question of the whole situation. I understand if there's a gap, because if you haven't... Now, we were occupied for 5 years during the war, and I was six when it started. But I remember when we had that summer house just 39, round about us there were flagpoles, and I remember my parents saying they would not like a flagpole in case they would have to put up a German flag. Mm. That's why we didn't get it. So I think it depends on the situation, how you honor the flag and what it stands for. And I know people in southern Jutland who were from 1864 up to 1920, they were occupied, or they were under German reign, so to speak. And they would cherish the flag at the bottom of a casket or box or somewhere, and waiting for the day when they could put it up again. So, but I understand you very much, because sometimes you don't want to be Danish when you think of some, bad literature we are exporting, and that sort of thing. So it depends, and you are thinking of the wartime.
Yes.
Very much depends on the situation.
because that was a moment in where the country, it's probably the last time in American history where the whole country really did come together. And it takes on all kinds of emotional connotations, which really aren't all bad. I want to read here also from the LCA document, because they aren't saying that patriotism as such, you know, is intrinsically wrong. This is, I think, a very nice little brief discussion here. The sentiments of patriotism will be intensely aroused by the celebration, that is the bicentennial. It is natural for human beings to find meaning and security in an allegiance to others. A sense of belonging originates in the family and extends to the local community, the nation, and we hope the global community. Human beings need to feel at home in space and time. An affection for one's land is part of what it means to be human, whether that land is limited by the boundaries of a tribe's migrations or extends to the fixed borders of a nation as large as the United States. The affection for one's land also expresses itself in criticism, for criticism signals caring. Patriotism at its best is critical concern for the common welfare of the people, and the land is a part of the global community, which I think is a nice way of stating that there are obviously going to be, you know, loyalties to certain specific geographical areas, because they have meaning. One problem in America is that one of my teachers at Wisconsin pointed out that contrasted to certain places in Europe, almost any piece of real estate in the United States is for sale. If you get the right price, no matter if it's an ancestral home, you know, you'll sell it. But you couldn't buy certain places in Europe. For instance, people wouldn't sell no matter what the price. They'd been living there for, you know, centuries. I think, for instance, many different places. And hence, there is that much greater attachment and loyalty. And in this country, we've been missing this for a long time. And so instead of having the attachment to a local place, we get the larger attachment to this thing we call the United States. And when threatened, you know, the common enemy, then it becomes something which goes beyond a reasonable or rational, I suppose I should say, kind of analysis, to where it becomes an emotional thing, and the symbols and the rituals which attend to it transcend our other kinds of loyalties, to where we feel that any threat to it is a threat to those things which, you know, we cherish very much. Yeah,
isn't there,
John?
A real need for what somebody said, an articulation of why we have, say, a flag in service. Now,
let's get back.
I remember long discussions about, you know, at which side should the flag be on. I thought which was right or left, but anyway, we finally came down on we put the Christian flag on the place of the gospel side, and the American flag on the supposedly the law side, or whatever. But I mean to say that by that we're making a statement that the flag had its place, but not the place. And then we had people arguing, well, the law says you can't have anything lower than the American flag, you know, as though, no, that had to be at the top. But I mean, the church council and congregation finally agreed that, no, that really wouldn't be right to have it, you know, right in the middle.
In the middle.
Above the... You know, that it had its place, but not the place. And so often we don't articulate. I mean, it's just there, and nobody asks any questions about it. And why do we honor it, or why do we not honor it? You know,
should the flag be the symbol, the political symbol of the ideals and values that we do hold together in common?
Sure.
And if we do not hold these values and ideals in common, then the flag ought not to be flown.
Wow.
A radical protest. I mean, that it should symbolize that you take it out. You know?
Okay.
Well, this is quite related. I think when I was growing up, it was a flag, and it was my country, right or wrong. Well, I think that we've all had to take a few thoughts about that. We realize how many wrong things that we have done in our history. And you really think, well, now, what am I being loyal to? Am I being loyal to all these wrong things? But I, for myself, I came, I said, well, this is my land, and no country, to my knowledge, has been without sin. I want to live here. I wouldn't live anyplace else. I think this is my home, and I'll work to to do what I can, which is probably not very much, to make it better. And there are a lot of good people here that are working toward that end. And all of it's like the kids, when they don't do everything I think they should do. My kids, I'm talking about. But I didn't stop claiming them as mine.
Okay. Barb?
Now, when I wrote a book, and I can't remember the name of it, but in it he talks about the rootless generation, and that we are, that the people that are my age now have grown up without roots, and under the constant threat of the atomic bomb, without any kind of a sense of a future at all, for our country or the world even, in that tomorrow it may not be here. You know, I live today because, without any kind of sense of tomorrow, because I'm just not sure it's going to be here. And, you know,
the world might be, but you won't be, so what's the difference?
What do you mean?
Well, you might not be here tomorrow, so why would you, I mean, why should that, the world or the something else not being here bother you? That's...
Okay, well, the thing I'm trying to say is that we don't really, you know, since tomorrow, I'm not sure I'm going to be here tomorrow. I have not been raised to see this, to project a future for America. And all I've seen in the years that I went to college, you know, everything was nothing but one negative thing after another, and I've grown cynical. And I think my generation, probably one of the more cynical generations there have been. Just, you know, because we, you know, man, why not? We don't know what's going to happen, you know. We have so little control over what happens to us, how we grow up, what we know, what we don't know, you know, whether we'll be here tomorrow. And so I guess my whole attitude, you know, has partially grown out of this cynicism, this, you know. And when I see the flag, I get a little cynical about that, you know. And I really struggle with that. I get a little cynical about the church sometimes, a little cynical about, you know,
Holden
Village.
Adults.
Adults, kids. People my own age, I'm not you know, I'm 25, I'm on my way, I hope someday. But, you know, and it's a real problem, you know, and I'm just reaching, and I'm just grasping sometimes, trying to get a hold of something like that, you know. Give me something I can hang on to. You know, I have been for so long now. And you know, I wish someone would explain to me what the flag means, you know. Like you said, like you were saying, you know.
Maybe part of the reason for that cynicism is that for so long we over-idealized what our country was and what it had done and what it was going to do and what it was for everyone. It's like the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, the liberty and justice for all. Are we claiming that as a reality, or are we looking at that as an ideal that we're working toward?
When I graduated from high school, I gave a speech, you know, about how happy I was to be, you know, and you have to give, some people have to give speeches last night, you know, and I really appreciated my teachers and my God and country and everything. And within 4 months, I was in a freshman in college, and I was out on the streets. I was, you know, walking along with the signs, you know, Kent State occurred my freshman year. The whole thing, just a complete opposite switch. You know, it was such a shock, but I'm still getting over it, you know. And our generation, you know, I really feel that.
There's another generation following yours, which listened to Governor Bowen at our bicentennial celebration, and he, it was a presentation that one might call typical, and there was a large crowd of students who listened to that with mostly with straight faces. And 5 or 6 years ago, there'd have been nobody there, and those that were there would have been giving raspberries. Mm-hmm. And here, there was a really quite unspectacular civic figure giving out the civic religion. Mm-hmm. And this was being listened to without that kind of background of protest. Mm-hmm. But not with any of the old rah-rah either. And I think this was a tremendously hopeful thing. You chat with those students who were there, and they are the successors to the generation of which has just been spoken, and the maturity of recognizing that there's something here that our lives would be poorer without. This long tradition of God having blessed America, because America was always on God's side and doing the right things, and God could do no less than do. Tradition got its fearful jolt. We had a war which we couldn't believe in anymore, and the necessity of facing up to the fact that one's nation could do evil things, and first then the heavy reaction of just spitting on the flag.
Yeah.
And now another generation is willing to not wave it rightfully much, but reaching for a flag that might be something that is a focus of values that somehow has flowed through underground, through that whole sweep of things, that we are know that they're a very cool bunch, the present generation. Mm.
Very, I found.
Yeah. And they're not going to be led around by the nose by any civic demagogueries. But there is an awareness that that's not all a bucket of ashes either.
And they don't want to buy in on the kind of anxious emptiness that she spoke of. Right.
No, I think that's true. I think we're really sort of sated by the cynicism now almost.
It runs its course. It's a cyclical thing.
It does. It, like in classes now, I took a couple of years in the middle of college and quit. So I kind of went some, yeah. And then I've come in again. And now if you get someone who's continually harping on Kent State or something like this, everyone kind of sits back and goes, mm-hmm. You know, they're going to leave soon, or will the professor please shut them up? Or?
Yeah.
And the most irrelevant professors are the unreconstructed.
Oh, yeah, right. Oh.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We've got a couple left over. And. No, it's 5:02. I don't want to break up, but it is lunchtime, and tomorrow I hope we can have a discussion of amnesty as a specific example of the tension here that does exist and is a very real problem for some people, but the tension between patriotism on the one hand and the Bible and the demands that the scriptures make on us on the other, because it's anything but an open and shut kind of case. See, and
well, yeah, 5 minutes.
5 minutes, yeah.
We haven't talked about the image of the United States as Israel. Now, I don't think for Lutherans this has been an awfully heavy thing,
no.
But it seems to me that part of the problem, that if the United States is Israel, then the whole world is our enemy, in a sense. But if we're not, then we've got things to learn from the rest of the world. And
well, it's like quoting the Declaration of Independence. When it suits our purposes, we become the children of Israel, and when it doesn't, we don't. It's a very useful thing to turn on and off over a long period of time. And this is one reason I'm so impressed with Abraham Lincoln, is that there's always this recognition of being under God's judgment.
Judgment, yeah, right.
Judgment is very strong there in Lincoln, that and avoiding this malice towards none and charity for all. And I think the Lincoln view, if that could prevail as our civil religion, and if that was the way in which, say, a flag was introduced in my local congregation as representing that rather than representing some chauvinistic view might be something else. But there is the problem is that obviously we all have different views and interpretations of this, because when I see a policeman, I'm a child of the 60s in that sense too, when I see a policeman, that's why I brought it up, wearing an American flag sewn on a shirt, I think of Chicago's daily Chicago policeman, you know, kicking hippies and beating them up. That's in the name of the red, white, and blue. And that's kind of hard to overcome because it did take place. So I don't know if we, that's why I raised the question, I don't know if we can come to any kind of consensus about this, but so long as we aren't fighting each other and there isn't any violence over there, there's still kind of hope. And as you say, the younger generation, which I would tend to agree with, is on more, you know, has a better start on this than some of the rest of us. Maybe there is some way to get around this. I don't know. But why don't we, yeah, Evelyn, have the benediction.
I guess the kind of American flag is the most beautiful thing. Was when I saw it in front of the American Embassy in Moscow.
Yeah, that's.
You see the contrast, boy. You know, that's so beautiful. I mean, it does stand, in spite of the wars and everything, you know, it stands for something about freedom.
Yeah. Eric Severide said once, too, you never see, you know, angry demonstrators throwing rocks and things at, you know, a Russian embassy. And I was always thought that American embassies all over the world should have a big demonstration area, you know, so they so let people go over and demonstrate and throw and bomb things over there if they want to, but leave the property alone. You know, they used to go and ransack the libraries all the time. Let them do their things and go away, because they know, you know, they could get by with it when they did it at the American, but no, nowhere else. And, you know, obviously that's a little too cynical, but I think that's a good way of finishing, okay? Yeah, we should. Come back tomorrow. That's a good way of getting you to come back tomorrow.
Thank you. It's been very interesting.
Thank you.